want to welcome everyone to this meeting of the New York State Climate Action Council Agriculture and Forestry Advisory Panel meeting. Appreciate your time. We have a pretty interesting meeting and a kind of a mixed agenda today for you. The goal of this meeting is really to better understand the work of the Climate Justice Working Group and think about equity considerations and assistance to disadvantaged communities and how that needs to be part of our recommendations. We're going to spend some time on that. In addition, we're going to have a follow-up discussion about the panel recommendation templates that Maureen Letty will assist us in. She's from the New York State Office of Climate Change and directs that. And then, we're going to hear from some updates on the subgroup leads. We'll get a status report from them. And then following this panel meeting, we're going to have a public engagement section that was going to be held to allow the public to have an opportunity to provide comment on recommendations that we're working on. So with that, first of all, I'd like to do a roll call. It's alphabetical, so you can prepare your mute buttons accordingly. Rafael Aponte.
Yes, present.
Thank you. Amanda Barber.
Present.
Thank you. John Bartow.
Present.
Thank you, John. Michelle Brown.
Present. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tom Giroux.
Present and accounted for. Thank you.
And accounted for. Suzanne Hunt.
I'm here. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Suzanne. Peter Innes.
Yes, good afternoon, Commissioner.
Good afternoon. Peter Lehner. Peter, are you with us? Samantha Levy, I believe, is not going to be able to join us, but are you there, Sam? Robert Melsheimer.
Present, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir. Stephanie Morningstar? Stephanie? John Noble? John, are you with us? Julie Suarez, I know, had a slight medical concern with her daughter. Ned Sullivan?
Yes, Commissioner, I'm here.
Thank you very much. Nelson Villarubia. Nelson. Donna Wadsworth.
Yes, Commissioner, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Elizabeth Walters.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Peter Woodbury.
Yes, good afternoon.
Thank you so much. We're going to have, as usual, additional state staff on the phone who will be reporting out and able to answer any of your questions or comments. From Ag and Markets, we've got Brian Steinmuller, Deputy Commissioner Dave Valesky, Jennifer Clifford. From DEC, we've got Peter Innes, Suzanne Hagel, and Maureen Letty, who will be presenting in a little bit, Jeff Mapes and Jason Drobnak. So thank you all. And I also want to welcome some folks who are attending from the Natural and Working Lands Working Group. That's made up of staff from various state agencies to help us do our work as well. A little bit of housekeeping here. I think we have a slide on this. I want to thank the members of the public who have joined us today and at the past panel meetings. And want to make sure that you fully understand how you can provide comments and some questions in addition to the open session that will be following this meeting. But to submit feedback to any panel members and agency staff during the meeting, the public can use the WebEx chat Q&A function located on the bottom right-hand corner. I do want to point out that due to our limited schedule and this being a working session, we're not going to be able to directly respond to questions issued by the general public during this meeting. Or those who are going to stay with us, you will have that opportunity in the public engagement section immediately following today's meeting. And of course, additionally, you can submit feedback at any time by emailing our dedicated email on the screen, agriculture.forestry@agriculture.ny.gov. It's easier to read that than it is to say that. So with that, we're going to get to work here. I want to introduce Rosa Mendez, who is the chair of the Climate Justice Working Group, and she's going to get us up to speed on just those issues and some of our panel concerns. So with that, Rosa.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here with you today. I think I had just two slides just to kind of keep my comments organized if we can advance to them. Great, thanks. I wanted to start with just the background on the working group for those of you who were not able to attend the Climate Justice Working Group meetings. We, as the working group, began meeting in August of 2020, and our membership is made up of representatives from communities that may be experiencing environmental justice issues, and we're from all over the state, including upstate urban areas, New York City, and rural communities. Additionally, we do have four state agency members, including from DEC, Department of Health, NYSERDA, and Department of Labor. And this working group has a few roles to play when we're considering implementation of the CLCPA, including a consultation role with the Climate Action Council and with the advisory panels so that they can inform the climate justice and equity elements of the scoping plan. The working group will also coordinate with state agencies for a few things, including a report on barriers and opportunities to access of clean energy, and with my agency, DEC, on development of a community air monitoring program, and on the rulemakings to achieve the statewide emission limits. But the role that we are focusing on, and that is critical for many elements of the CLCPA, is establishing criteria to identify disadvantaged communities for the purposes of co-pollutant reductions, greenhouse gas emission reductions, regulatory impact statements, and the allocation of benefits associated with state investments. All of this information, as well as information on our meetings, our meeting recordings, our minutes from those meetings and PowerPoint presentations are available on the climate.ny.gov website. And we can go to the next slide, please. So the criteria for disadvantaged communities, we do have a bit of a framework from the CLCPA, and we've taken to calling the list in the CLCPA as the three pillars. So the three pillars that our criteria should reflect, and that includes areas burdened by cumulative environmental pollution, so getting to that environmental justice piece, and other hazards that can lead to negative public health effects. And then we have a pillar on socioeconomic information, so areas with concentrations of people that are of low income, high unemployment, high rent burden, low levels of educational attainment or home ownership, or members of groups that have historically experienced discrimination on the basis of race or ethnicity. And then the final pillar is for areas vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, such as flooding, storm surge, and urban heat island effects. This definition will inform the state benefits mandate, which, as a reminder, is the minimum of 35% of benefits of clean energy investments with a goal of 40% of benefits accruing in disadvantaged communities. We're developing this criteria with input from the public, and the plan is to host 6 public statement hearings and to publish a draft of the criteria for public comment on the DEC website. Within coming up with this criteria, there are a lot of considerations we have to take, including how are we going to apply the criteria? And that includes looking for available data to support that criteria. we came up with a work plan in the beginning of our process, and we tried to match our timeline with the timeline for the draft scoping plan, because that's when the definition is going to be most helpful to the advisory panels and the Climate Action Council. And we expect to have our definition in the summer of 2021, and that includes the public comment period, which we, from the legislation, are required to have 120 days for public comment. Where we are now is we've gone through a process with the working group members to compile a universe of potential indicators or criteria. And we came up with an evaluation rubric to cut that list down by at least half, because the universe that we talked about came out to over 130 potential indicators. We did an application of that rubric, and that evaluation includes whether the indicator reflects one of those pillars from the legislation that I ran through. How unique is that indicator? So looking at what does it contribute to the criteria? Is it something that's capturing the concept? So is it capturing the concept of low income directly, or is it an indirect measure of that concept? And whether the data is available and sufficient for use in this process, because we really want the criteria to be impactful, and it, if the data isn't available across the state, there's going to be problems with representation, right? Or if the data isn't collected often, there's going to be a problem in the future with our use of that data for this purpose. All this work is being supported by a state staff team and a consultant who's helping us with the evaluation of the data and with the methodology for how to use this kind of criteria. At our most recent meeting in January, January 27th, we went through the initial rubric application, including a gap analysis of which criteria scored very high and which scored very low, but for the pillar that they represent, did we have enough indicators score high for the pillars that we need to reflect from the legislation? And we are now downloading the data that supports those indicators that scored highest on the rubric. Our plan for February is to hear from California environmental justice representatives about their experience with the California model for identifying disadvantaged communities. I'm sure many of you are aware that California has done this in the past, and they've done a few iterations of identifying disadvantaged communities. So we're really looking to learn from their experience and not replicate any problems that they ran into with coming up with a way to geographically indicate where disadvantaged communities are. And we also are working to get to consensus on the list of criteria that we want to put out as a draft for public engagement. And finally, we want to continue engagement with the advisory panels. We did have some initial engagement with advisory panels in December and with the waste panel at our last meeting. From Ag and Forestry, Julie Suarez gave us an overview at our December 16th meeting of your panel and the scope that you're working with. And she did answer some questions at that time from the working group members. We are organizing for follow-up engagement with all of the panels, and unfortunately, schedules could not fit for today's meeting with Ag and Forestry, but we are continuing to work with your state staff team to get follow-up engagement with that panel. And there's a couple of ways we can do that. We can try to organize another time for a virtual meeting, or if this panel has something prepared that they want feedback on, we can share that with the working group to get their response to what you've prepared. And that's it for my update, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have at this point.
Panel, any questions for Rosa?
Yeah, this is, so actually have two questions, Rosa.
Sure.
So the first one is, how are you guys dealing with the monitoring that you could identify improvement, for example, in a designated disadvantaged community, but then be able to distinguish, is it actual improvement of the residents that were in the community and are just getting better conditions, or is it a result of gentrification? Because we often see in upstate that it's typically gentrification than on the ground improvement. That's the first question. Second question is, are you at all looking forward, seeing where certain policies or regulations or something that are a result of this scoping plan could render a community disadvantaged because of, let's say, a major plant closing or something that could occur?
Chris, I'll answer your first question. We do, as a working group, we are directed to continue meeting even after all of this process of identifying the criteria is done. And it's exactly for your point to evaluate the communities that are being identified and if they still fit the definition or if our criteria are not capturing the communities that we really are trying to direct benefits to because they're underinvested or what have you. And I think your second question relates similarly, right? How are we going to evaluate to see if communities are impacted by policies that are found in the scoping plan? And that's something that we're still considering and how we're going to do. I imagine there would be another sort of evaluation rubric or process that we would follow, including public engagement, because we really want to focus on the experience on the ground and hear from community members. So that's definitely something that we'll be considering in our upcoming public engagement and in the future.
Thank you.
Good question, John. Thank you. Other questions for Rosa?
Yeah, Rosa, Tom Giroux from Wagner Lumber Company. Thanks for your explanation on what your panel is doing. I'm curious, after you heard Julie's presentation on ag and forestry and what we've been up to, were there any first impressions on areas that may be impacted by what we're doing as far as disadvantaged communities and where forestry and agriculture are going to overlap with disadvantaged communities? Were there any initial thoughts on that after?
The two that I can recall, because I don't want to speak for the working group members because they really are the ones who represent communities in New York. But the two that I recall that came up were there was some back and forth with Julie over carbon capture and on the question of biofuels that came up during our initial engagement with her.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, hi, this is Suzanne. I was just curious what issues were or what issues have been the trickiest and most difficult that you guys have had to kind of grapple with?
In terms of the criteria, there's a lot of discussion and we're planning on having a more focused session on this, on the complexities when you're using a place-based designation. We understand that a lot of data is captured at different levels of granularity. So that's one of the complications, is some of the indicators that might be a direct measure of one of those pillars that we're interested in may only be available at a census tract level, or some are even less granular than that. And we're working with our consultant on, are there other ways we can use that information? And that's another thing we plan on asking the California team, because they've gone through this and they've gone through methods of grouping criteria. And that's another area we're exploring, is how much weight does each pillar get, right? What is most important for identifying a disadvantaged community? And how much weight are we gonna assign to different elements? For example, in the EPA's EJ screen, they weigh everything with the socioeconomic information.
So that means, you know, they take their pollution burden and they multiply it by the indicator that captures low income and concentrations of people of color. California does it a different way. So those are some of the things we're still exploring that go towards the methodology of how you use the criterion.
Thanks.
President, this is Amanda. I just was going to ask, have you, in sort of starting your analysis, have you found that there is significant overlap between these? Because that's what I'm reading and seeing.
Right, and that's why in our evaluation tool, one of the things we talked about was uniqueness, because some of the indicators that were suggested are made up of a direct measure of something along with a measure of low income, right? So it's already capturing a low income element in it, but we also have a direct measure of low income. So those are the kinds of things that our rubric was trying to get at, so that we're not stacking up too many in one pillar, and you know that would make another pillar negligible, right? If you have too many on one side.
Okay.
So I will say what we found doing our analysis is the area where we are lightest for indicators is that third pillar on climate vulnerability. So we're continuing to have conversations with other state agencies that are on our state staff team for what kinds of data they collect that could support as an indicator for climate vulnerability.
So if I could just make a comment, Rosa, thank you very much for the excellent presentation and the thoughtful process that you've shared. It's Ned Sullivan from Scenic Hudson speaking. And I just want to commend you for the combination of a data-driven approach in conjunction with actual outreach to community members in areas that are considered disadvantaged and environmental justice, and having listening sessions where you hear from people who are experiencing disproportionate environmental impacts from existing facilities or who may be experiencing things like flooding, storm surges because of where they're located, and or overflow of tributaries. I think there are environmental justice communities that are already experiencing the impacts of climate change. And so I think figuring out how to fold those experiences into a forward-looking climate justice strategy will be very important.
Great, thank you.
Thank you again.
Hi, this is, go ahead, Robert, you have it. I'll take next.
Oh, okay, thank you. Rosa, this might sound like a really strange question, but I'm just kind of wondering, what are you thinking about and looking at in regards to what it, like this minimum size for a community, or what is the definition of a community? I'm just trying to kind of, you know, obviously there's larger communities and there's smaller communities, and I'm just trying to understand kind of, you know, what is, how are you defining that?
And you're getting to one of our questions that we're going to have a focus session on. We're calling it the place-based conversation to get exactly at that question. Right now, what we're seeing is the census tract level works very well in other models we've seen, right? So it's, you know, California is at the census tract, I believe. And other models we looked at in Washington State and other municipalities have done it at that level. And I think that plays into the data accessible, you know, where data is available idea. So, but we are going to have a more focused session on that place-based geography question.
Oh, Thank you, Rosa. I think that goes into my question. Hi, this is Rafael Ponte. I had a general question around the data and trends around it. Do we have an idea of where data is most robust and where it's lacking? I know we talked about, you know, place-based and geographies, but is there a urban-rural split? Is there a, you know, some kind of data around current level of investment versus, you know, lack of? That's one question. And the second question was, where does food fit in as an indicator around concentrations in disadvantaged communities?
For the first half of your question, that's an area of complexity that we're grappling with, you know, the urban versus rural, because quite a few of the indicators we're looking at. So, for example, thinking about cumulative environmental pollution, what we're seeing is a lot of that skews downstate, right? And we're trying to look at a way to make sure that we're not weighing our indicators so that there's most of the benefits are going to one part of the state and not the other, because we know that there are disadvantaged communities across New York. So that's one thing we're working on with our consultant. And then your second question about food, some of the indicators that were highlighted did have to do with food access. And we're trying to figure out how they relate to some of the other indicators in that second pillar, that pillar about areas of concentrations of people that are low income or have high rent burden. So the food access question came in under that pillar as well.
Thank you.
Disadvantaged communities in urban areas. It's a little more challenging in the rural communities. In so many cases, some of our rural counties, the people there are highly vulnerable to impacts of climate change. I'm thinking particularly of my own county, Schoharie County, with flooding and storm surge kind of things that happen with the flood. No less important, a little bit trickier to try to get at and try to measure. So appreciate the challenge you're working with there.
And these are some of the questions that we are going to ask of the California EJ team, because they went through the same experience. And one of the ways their legislature tried to get more investment into parts of California that are less urban is they have a separate legislation that directs funding into areas using just income as the factor. So that's one way that California tried to deal with the urban versus rural issue. So, you know, we're trying to organize that meeting for February, and we post everything on our website. So if you're interested in listening in on that with the California team, I'll make sure that I also reach out directly to Brian and Maureen to make sure that you get that information as well.
That would be appreciated. Thank you. I didn't mean to jump in there, but there are other questions for Rosa while we have her. Okay. Go ahead, please. Oh.
Oh, sorry about that. This is Brian Steinler from the Department of Ag and Markets. Rosa, thank you. Just kind of one question that builds off of the commissioner's remarks there. Looking at that that third area, areas vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, such as flooding, a number of our practice systems or conservation systems that we have implemented for numerous objectives over the years, and you know, we'll be implementing here as well for climate mitigation adaptation, also have resiliency benefits, downstream benefits, flood mitigation. And I guess I was just curious to know how those areas will be identified, whether there is the ability to pull in data and map those areas so we can, again, you know, look at focusing our efforts where it's most needed, you know, for flood mitigation and resiliency.
Yeah, that's something that our consultant is working on. Where there's data available, if we can use it to create a mapping layer, that's something that would be really helpful. And I think, Brian, you're on the state staff team, or someone from Magna Marcus is on there. So you're aware that our consultant is reaching out for and asking those very questions of the state agencies.
That's great. And, you know, again, building off of the commissioner's comments and the flooding impacts from 2011 and 12 and other years where they might not have been as widespread, but no less devastating. You know, our conservation districts across the state have a lot of good information. You know, we may be able to assist in putting some of that together with your consultant and certainly with DEC.
Great. I just made a note of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else got a question for Rosa?
Yes, Commissioner, I had one more thought. Ned Sullivan here again. We've been out in communities working on specific solar projects proposed by developers and encountering a lot of resistance to new solar projects. And as I look and, you know, sort of zero in on the fact that a minimum of 35% of the benefits of clean energy investments will go to disadvantaged communities, I think it's important to find out what kinds of investments would be welcome and embraced by those disadvantaged communities, because I think one of the big obstacles to implementation of the governor's vision for new energy facilities is getting community support. So as you're having listening sessions, I think it would be, you know, really important to find out what are the types of things that those disadvantaged communities would consider beneficial to them in clean energy investments by private parties or the state. Overcoming those obstacles is going to be key.
Great, thank you. Good points, and another one that we can, not just for the Climate Justice Working Group, but for the state agencies as they think about their investments in the coming years.
Thank you.
This has been a pretty good discussion. I'm sorry, was someone about to ask a question? Okay. This has been a great discussion. Rosa, thank you for being here and leading that. I'm encouraged a little bit reading the news this morning and my ag news feeds, et cetera, that the nominee for USDA Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, has highlighted in his opening remarks two main issues that he will address with high priority are racial equity and climate change. And he's a, we know Tom is his former role as Secretary of Agriculture and a pretty strong rural individual, proponent of rural concerns, rural development. And also the EPA nominee by the president, Michael Regan. He mentioned he has two goals as he goes forward at EPA, one to restore science transparency, but to focus on marginalized communities and a little more sense of urgency on climate change. So I think there's some federal parallel tracks going on here, and obviously we're aware of many other states like California that are undertaking the same thing. So hopefully we can benefit from and not have to go through some of the same pitfalls as the other areas. But I think there's some optimism on both these subjects. So Rosa, thank you very much for your time with us today, and please stay in touch with us. Let us know how we can engage further and pay attention to that California discussion as well.
Thank you, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you. We're going to now shift gears a little bit and get back to following up our discussion on recommendations template and the integration analysis. And Maureen, can you lead that discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me back to the panel meeting. You'll recall at our last panel meeting, we talked a bit about now process-wise as the groups are sort of coming into the home stretch of recommendations development, the format and the parameters around what the final work product from the panel would look like. That the last council meeting, a recommendation template PowerPoint slide or two were presented by Kara Allen of NYSERDA. That physical deck is available and I believe will be distributed via the subgroups of this advisory panel. And you also have received that written Word document, which is a bit like an instruction guide on how to populate the template. So I wanted to look at those slides again, talk a bit about them, and just answer any questions that the advisory panel members might have about the expectations for their final work product and any open questions regarding that, this next level of effort. So next slide, please. So the package itself of slides that will go to the council, there'll be a covering slide, which is like a list of just name of like a summary where you would say, here's my strategies, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then there's a series of slides that go into detail on what those strategies are. And they're lumped into three main categories. These are mitigation strategies where you have a greenhouse gas reduction or a sequestration, either, via direct reduction in emissions or through sequestration. Then there's these what are called enabling strategies, things that don't necessarily have a direct emissions reduction, but they enable the mitigation strategy to either occur or magnify the effect of that. We think about like outreach, things of that nature, things like education, potentially like assisting in loans, things that enable something to occur. And then the final bucket are the adaptation and resilience strategies. The adaptation and resilience work is trailing a little bit behind the mitigation work. The mitigation work is being really driven by the need to run the information through the analytical engine, where the adaptation and resilience doesn't have that hard deadline, so we can focus on mitigation and then start working on adaptation, which is a natural sort of pairing. Once you have a sense of what the mitigation strategies look like, then you can start thinking about the adaptation and resilience aspects of those strategies. So I believe that work group will be kicking off fairly soon. It's being managed by the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. And the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel is also looking at broadly adaptation and resilience, where each panel is looking more, quote, narrowly at their specific strategies. That Land Use and Local Government will be making sort of statewide recommendations around adaptation and resilience for inclusion in the scoping plan. So each one of those different types of recommendations follows the basic same format in these slide templates with slight variations. So the enabling strategies don't have this field for GHG reduction by 2030 and 2050 because by nature they don't have direct emissions. And again, the adaptation and resilience don't have that kind of thing. They look a bit differently at the hazard that it's addressing rather than the actual emissions resultant. But other than that, they basically follow the same layout where you have a brief description of what it is, what the type of action is, if it's a proposed regulation, if it's an incentive program, if it's a legislative, all sorts of different ways that you go about doing this. and what the estimated reductions in emissions are. And what we're looking for here are high, medium, low categories that are defined in an appendix section of this package of slides. So we don't expect the advisory panels to have done, you know, a deep analysis to get down to a discrete number of pounds of CO2e or what have you, but to have a general sense in a relative scale of if this is going to result in a large amount or a small amount, and it's all in relation to sectoral emissions as a whole. So not looking at it on a statewide basis, but looking at it compared to the agriculture. So is this going to reduce a high amount of emissions for this sector, or a low, or somewhere in between? And the cost and funding considerations are, again, not looking for very detailed numbers, but a high, medium, low in buckets that are also defined in that appendix so that we can understand. And the enabling strategies are different, have different high, medium, low grades, because we expect mitigation strategies will be more costly than enabling strategies. So putting them in the same high, medium, low categories seemed wouldn't be as meaningful. So then some idea of the ease of implementation. And if there is an example case study that the panel and subgroup is looking to as an example, to provide that as well, to say, well, this happened in, you know, the Netherlands, or this happened in California or some other place, to say, this is where we're basing this strategy from. And it, there's an ability to provide more detail on that case study in you know, in supplementary slides if the panel chooses to do so. So if you want to highlight that case study as a good example for the state to follow, you can provide additional detail in supplemental slides. So then there's a section on different risks and barriers to success and mitigants to those. So if you're thinking about when you're developing your strategy, you know, to think clearly about the level of success, what are the risks that we could befall, and how would we address those risks? And so that's the overview slide. So then the next slide then lays out all the steps to deliver. So the strategy itself is the big high level thing, and these are the different actual things we would do to get that done. So if we think about in terms of this panel, one of the strategies is avoiding land conversions. So that's the overall arching strategy. And then there's a series of actions that we recommend taking to achieve that strategy. So those would be laid out on this slide here, and identify who's the likely lead to implement this component. And what's the time frame? Is this something that could happen in the near term? Is this something that could happen, you know, way out into the future? And then other entities that you'd need to engage to develop that strategy. So, you know, if you need to engage local governments, other different stakeholders that might be important to include in that strategy development. So next slide, please. And then this is a slide on the benefits and impacts that are anticipated from the strategy. So what are the benefits and impacts to disadvantaged communities, health and other co-benefits, and just transition considerations, business, industries, workers, risks of leakage. And then there's a general category for other, where if there's things that are, you know, key to this strategy that are a benefit or an impact that are not captured by those three buckets, there's an ability to add that information. And, you know, these are put out slide by slide. If it's not a big deal to take two slides of anticipated benefits and impacts if filling those cells drives you onto a second slide, right? You're not limited to keep it to one if that's, you know, if there's a lot to say. But, you know, the intention of doing it on a PowerPoint presentation is to sort of keep it condensed, you know, not to kind of have a digestible form of presentation. And is that the package of filled out with information are then provided to the council in advance of the meeting, so they have a chance to to read through, digest, you know, think about what their questions might be, and then really have an engaged discussion at the council meeting. That obviously would not fit into a 3-hour Climate Action Council meeting, so we're looking at other alternatives in April to have a second meeting so that we can split out the, you know, those presentations to make sure there's adequate time for the council and the panel to have a robust discussion about their strategies that they're presenting. So then, you know, the package of slides, like I said, will basically replicate these three for each of those strategy types. There'll be slight differences that are appropriate to those. And then that whole, you know, that whole package will be presented up. So if there's any questions on that, I'm happy to take them now.
Maureen, for case studies, thank you very much. This was great to go through all this. But if we have case studies of work that's been done in here in New York, we can utilize that research as well. We don't have to look outward, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Maureen, thank you. That was really helpful. This is Bob Malmsheimer. I just had two quick questions for you. One is, when we think about these strategies, how specific are you looking for us to be? In other words, you know, on, I think it was the second slide, you know, are we talking about kind of principles that should be involved in implementing a particular strategy, you know, guideposts or you know, I'm assuming you're not looking for legislative language, that type of thing.
That's correct. Yeah, no. I mean, so we'll use a regulation as an example. You have an idea of a regulatory mechanism that could be beneficial to achieving a sequestration goal. The intention is, and that's, you know, developing a regulation, there's a whole bunch of outreach, there's a whole bunch of considerations that go into understanding how to formulate and structure that regulation so that it works, you know, it works for all involved. So that's a process that would follow naturally as is required by law. But what we are looking for here is to say, you know, we think that a regulation to do such a thing without putting the regulatory language or all sorts of, you know, detail of that level is not what we're looking for here. But some of the benefits and impacts can be described, right? So you could say, well, if we're putting out regulation, we want to protect for X. We want to ensure we don't have this outcome of Y from it. And that would be part of the development of the regulation, which would happen, obviously, subsequent to the finalization of the scoping plan.
Great. That's very, very helpful. And then the only other question I had was, I don't see anything in here for us to indicate either level of importance or preference. I mean, in other words, there may be some strategies that we as a group decide these are critical, you know, in the ag and or forestry sector, and others that we, you know, that are very important, but not necessarily critical. And so I'm just kind of wondering, is there a mechanism? Is that something that we're not supposed to be doing? Is order of preference or, you know, putting them into importance, you know, from a category perspective?
So my understanding is really when, you know, when the council starts looking at this stuff, the thought of, and they're, the reason why these have more than just two parameters is because there are all kinds of considerations. But I think if I was to look at it from their point of view, I would look at the low-cost, high-emissions reduction strategies and say, we really want to dig in on these and start to see, okay, well, this is low-cost and high-emissions reduction, but it has all these downsides, so actually we shouldn't go that way. But there, you know, that doesn't reflect what you're saying to sort of say like, well, this might be high cost and it might be low reductions, but there's all these other benefits. And I think that's what has to come through in those subsequent slides. And that, you know, that other category, I'd say, would be a place to make a justification of why such a strategy, you know, is really key. Like, and it potentially this comes maybe with the enabling strategies where you say, listen, this is really necessary to make this happen for these reasons.
Great. Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Maureen, this is Amanda. I just had a question. I know it's something that's come up in the past, but at the time these are presented, all cross-sector communication and collaboration will have presumed to have occurred already, correct?
That's correct. To a degree, as much as we can upfront realize where we should have be doing such a thing, it should be done. But there could, other things could be realized when everything starts to be looked at together. And, you know, there is, it's not that, you know, once these are delivered to the council, everybody on the panel's on a gag order and can no longer participate in the process. Like, that's, we don't foresee that being the case at all, that this will continue to kind of iterate, and the integration analysis could reveal certain things, and there could be opportunities where the council might want to tap the panel again for some further clarification or some additional thinking on what is at the table.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Maureen? Awesome.
Hi, this is Peter Lehner. Just a process question, and forgive me if you already addressed this, but I had to jump on and off. Is the thought that some of us will start filling some of these in rough form and then share them with staff? Is there going to be a list of these? So if I have some ideas and someone else has some ideas and the third and staff has some ideas, we're not all working on the same thing. How are we coordinating? And forgive me if you already addressed that.
Nope, that hasn't been addressed. And I would say from my discussions with other staff from Ag and Marcus that this will be sort of managed at the subgroup level. So I'll leave it to the subgroup leads to sort of make that decision. I would assume that some staff have already, not in Ag and Markets, but in other panels, have already started kind of filling these out to sort of see how they're going to look and where they might need to start to where there's gaps, right, in their strategy development. So I think that we'll leave that to the subgroup. But I would guess staff will probably make a start, and the subgroups will refine. And this is also for the, you know, for the commissioner to decide. But likely, you know, these will come together for the full panel to look at before, you know, before they advance
just
council.
To reiterate, then each of the it will be each of the subpanels we're on. The leader of the staff leader of that subpanel will sort of organize the drafting process of these recommendation templates. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Terrific. Thank you so much for clarifying that.
All right. Thank you. Maureen, can you also take a minute and just speak about greenhouse gas emission accounting, how that's going to be analyzed and fit the scoping plan?
Sure. So as everybody knows, DEC was tasked with developing the emission limits under the new CLCPA accounting, which we did, and we put forth at the end of last year, but that, of course, is for 1990. And what we need to look at now is to bring all of that new accounting up to date. So the staff at DEC and NYSERDA have been working on that, you know, this whole time, working on that data. And what we would like to do is take what we have as, you know, really rough draft of the most recent emissions data to sort of, so that panels can see where they are today to better understand the level of ambition that they need to be, you know, to be reaching for, as compared to what we knew when we were shown the integration analysis back in June, which of course was based on 2016 data under the old accounting methodology. And the other thing about the integration analysis data is, you know, now That was kicked off to support the state energy plan, right? It was very focused on the energy system, and the integration analysis that's envisioned here is economy-wide. It's meant to think more broadly and to take in all sorts of pieces that weren't modeled as robustly the first time around. So that's, you know, that's the, that iterative integration process that I kind of alluded to earlier. How these, you know, these strategies will all be kind of fed into that process. They'll be cranked out, and an output will come, and it'll kind of give us scenarios for the future. It'll let us know if we are, if the strategies put together on whole and how they interact with each other are going to achieve the 40% and the 85%, and at what cost. And then that will start sort of a, you know, an iteration process I highly doubt that we're going to hit it right the first time, that the, you know, we'll get some information and we'll need to go and make some changes. And that will, you know, that'll keep informing the process as we go forward. Was that answering your question, Commissioner? Or was there something else you were, or anybody else want to chime in on that?
No, that was it. Perfect.
Yeah, this is John Bartow, Maureen. On that, I mean, we have a number of, in our subpanels, recommendations coming out about monitoring specific to natural working lands or natural lands. And I mean, to what extent would we try to advance a monitoring recommendation, or should we just not do it? And the same as it goes to outreach and education. The recommendations will come from multiple subpanels, and they span across at least the ag and forestry subpanels. I would assume that they're going to be across a lot of other advisory panels as well.
Yeah, and that's a good point, John. Like I think when the subgroups come together and start to look at the full suite of panel recommendations, those opportunities for combining certain things, like outreach and education, where it makes sense to say, well, we should pull these two pieces or three pieces and put it into one outreach strategy, will become apparent. And that's going to be an important part of knitting all this together. And I would say likely that, you know, as all these subpanels put forth their work, that's something that the staff will be doing, is looking at this all together as a whole and flagging these things. And saying, you know, so that when you do come as a panel, you're prepared to sort of, you know, think quickly or make decisions about those things, that not everybody's looking at something for the first time. And your first question, you were saying recommendations around monitoring, and what exactly do you mean, like physical monitoring systems?
So you know, this comes right to the heart of the sequestration question, you know, which you pointed out in the earlier emissions regulation is going to be very critical. And one of my concerns, or our concerns, has been that for the natural working lands, the monitoring, measuring, accounting of sequestration is done uniformly.
Mm-hmm.
Both for agriculture and forestry. I mean, that you're not mixing apples and oranges when you get there at the end of the day. So we have and at least that I can see right now, we don't have a very robust monitoring and accounting from. It's probably going to take us a while to get that done. It is critical. I mean, as you point out in the emissions regulation that you just did, measuring sequestration and then what do we do about it is going to be a big deal, particularly as we get in the out years. But making sure we have in place consistent all the way across the natural working lands, a consistent monitoring, measuring.
Mm-hmm. I understand. I understand where you're going with that. And I do agree. I think that's been, you know, in voluntary carbon markets and things like that, that's been a stumbling block a lot of the times, is, you know, the, how do you measure this? How do you verify it? You know, you're right. That is an important component. I think I would suggest that you should definitely, you know, include that. But of course, that's up to the, you know, the different subgroups and stuff to debate.
Agree. I just think it's something we've all thrown ideas out. We have not come to any consensus on.
Got it.
Sure, how much of that's going to depend. I mean, it's got, probably going to involve a lot of discussion with broader folks at DEC and NYSERDA as well, since you're ultimately going to have to put in place this verification piece. And then when you raised, another question for me when you brought up the compliance markets and what are the carbon markets and whatnot. I mean, that I read it right now, the CLCPA really is not favorable to a carbon compliance or voluntary market. If that's something we're going to look at, should we as subpanels be making recommendations in there that, number one, we think something of that like that would be of usefulness, but number two, it's got a huge barrier to get through in terms of dealing it with the CLCPA. And then it has other questions that it could go along into. In other words, selling credits outside of the state doesn't help our CLCPA targets. Mm-hmm. How do you bring those up?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the statute itself doesn't get in the way of any kind of voluntary carbon market. The carbon markets are obviously incredibly tricky, and the key questions are, you know, who's paying, who's going to pay for that value? Not that the value is not there, there's value, it's just who pays for it and how do we set that value? But now we're going off on a tangent that we could spend a lot of time talking about.
Sure, I realize that. So it's a big question. And I think if I'm reading the statute correct, the alternative compliance mechanism would be extremely challenging for an offset sold in even a voluntary or a compliance market.
Right. Well, and the other thing to make clear, right, is that the alternative compliance mechanism is, it's optional. It's something that DEC can use, that not DEC is required to use to ensure compliance. So really any kind of recommendations around the alternative compliance mechanism aren't really appropriate for the scoping plan because, you know, that's not, we might never use that. And you're right, like the statute does put some very strict limitations on what would qualify.
Agree.
Older subject, but thank you. Thanks for raising it, Jen. Thanks for handling all of that, Maureen. Did you want to add anything else, Maureen, or are you good?
I'm all set. Thank you so much. Of course, I always leave the door open. Any additional questions or issues people have, please reach out. I'm happy to answer questions.
You bet. Thanks so very much. We're going to, we're running close on time here to get to our public engagement session coming up at 2:30. But we do want to hear about the status of our subgroups and next steps that they envision. I think we're going to start off with Brian Steinmuller.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. Next slide, please. Thank you. So I'm just going to briefly touch on the agricultural-related subgroups, which include agroforestry, nutrient management, soil health, and livestock dairy. So we've held two subgroup meetings for each of those actual subgroups, subtopics. And we are intending to hold another series of subgroup meetings within the next couple of weeks in mid-February. And as Maureen indicated, we now have a PowerPoint template that we know will be the format for our recommendations, and the staff who are leading those subgroups at Ag and Markets are currently taking in all of the comments, the thoughts, and suggestions that we've received thus far from our panelists, and putting those comments into that format. So we intend to provide a draft running PowerPoint copy, if you will, to all of our sub-panels in advance of our next series of meetings to give us something to focus on, to give us and give all the panelists an opportunity to react before we actually have those meetings. We've heard from We've heard from experts in the field, and we've heard from panelists from their own experience in the first two subgroup meeting series, and again, taking what we've learned from those presentations and that information as well, and putting all that into the template. So, and to answer Peter Lehner's question, we do intend, like I said, to get all that information out to the panelists in advance and ahead of time. With that said, we'll send out that PowerPoint template that Maureen just went through as well to all the panelists. And if you have ideas and suggestions that you'd like to put into that and provide to us as well, Ag and Market staff, myself, Jennifer Clifford, Greg Albrecht, we work as a team to lead these subgroup meetings, and we would be glad to receive your thoughts in that template as well, even prior to us sending it to you all. So our intent here is to have this next series of subgroup meetings, and hopefully from that point we'll have our recommendations templates to a point where we can exchange ideas and thoughts and drafts via email in preparation for our next panel meeting, where we would report out on those drafts. So that's essentially, Commissioner, what is planned for the agroforestry, nutrient management, soil health, and also the livestock dairy subgroups. And I want to thank all the panel members for their commitment to those subgroups and bearing with us as we wrap up and finalize the scheduling for the final series of meetings.
Great. Thank you, Brian.
I'd be happy to take any questions if there are any.
Okay.
Okay. And I believe I will hand it over to Peter Ennis, who might then hand it over to staff of the Division of Lands and Forests to cover the next slide. But if you could advance, Jake, two slides forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian and Commissioner. Jason Drobnek will cover this advisory panel, and so Jason should be on, and I'll stop my video and mute myself.
Thank you. Yes, our group has been, we've had two subgroup meetings. Both have been under the improved forest management or improving forest sequestration in our forest category. We spent most of the first meeting looking at developing a new carbon option for 480A, and we talked quite extensively. And John Bartow had brought this up about additionality and how do we get that, and you know, making sure the accounting is correct if we're spending public money for some of these things, and making sure we're getting the bang for our buck, as I sort of speak here. The second meeting focused on other ways to get carbon sequestration, and we also threw in a little bit of a curveball and had a about sort of the enabling initiative idea. So we did talk a little bit about what other ways or programs could we develop to increase sequestration in our forests. Of carbon option for AEM, and again, we are talking, we need to be able to separate these programs out, so we're not doubling up on the public money or piggybacking, I think, is what we're kind of coming away with on that. I had started looking at the recommendation template, and I've been putting some stuff in there from based on the conversations and the comments. I haven't shared that with the group yet, but I will. We had gotten, and the next meeting will be focused on afforestation and reforestation. And then we may focus the next meeting after that on urban forestry, or we're pr- probably going to have to start looking at these recommendations and the actual language of them more closely. We'll share the information via email with that, and I'll have a discussion with them on Tuesday about how we want to kind of go ahead with that. The panel's it's a difficult topic. It's fun to think about it and get trees in the ground or figure out a way to increase kind of our role in this law. So we appreciate the opportunity. I didn't have much else than that. If anybody wanted to sort of throw in on that, they could.
Thanks, Jason. Does anyone have any questions for Jason? All right, thank you. As you mentioned, there's quite a bit of internal working group discussions, and Jason can attest that him and I speak daily, basically, and go over some ideas and talk things out, so it's very useful. Can we go to the next slide, please? And Jeff Mapes is going to be carrying this particular topic, the avoided conversion.
All right. So we've had three meetings so far. Our first one looked at forest conservation, both through fee and conservation easement acquisition, as well as the existing forest tax law and maybe some variance on that. The second meeting we focused on farmland conservation, looking at the present situation as well as some actions for that, which talked about conservation easement acquisition as well as some other tax and other related programs around ag lands. The third meeting we looked at some options that went beyond acquisition or tax program and to look at other incentives to landowners. Our next meeting is scheduled for next week, and we're going to have a couple presentations to look at some research around what's going on presently as far as land conversion, and looking at the pace and looking to forecast out into the future, and also to look at opportunities to avoid emissions from land conversion as well as sequestration. And then something that we'll probably talk about at a meeting beyond that next one is thinking about looking at a policy around no net loss of forest land, if that's a viable option. But that's where we are presently. And any questions?
Jeff, this is John Bartow. With respect to, you mentioned the easements acquisition and whatnot, but mentioned it only with reference to agriculture. We had been discussing a number of the same tools for forests as well.
Oh, I thought I had mentioned that when I talked about our forest conservation conversation, that we okay. talked about being easement as well as tax policy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
The one that keeps coming up is, and we really haven't completely addressed it yet, but the whole conversion associated to renewable energy development, deployment, and transmission, and issues that are there.
That's a great one to bring up, John. I will point out that Sarah Crowell with the Land Use and Local Government panel is going to take up some of those issues, particularly solar. with a cross-panel meeting later this month. I know there's going to be at least three other panels that will be participating with her on that.
Good to know. I've had an ever-increasing amount of folks talking about forest conversion over the last month. So, yeah. And I'm sure you've had a lot with AgLand.
Every now and then, yep.
Yep, thank you.
Peter, anything else from your team?
No, Commissioner, I think we're all set. As Jason mentioned, the working group staff are starting to populate that template and that Word document, and we'll be sharing that shortly with the panel members and the subgroup members to get their feedback, so we appreciate that. We appreciate, as Brian and the Commissioner mentioned, we can't say enough about the assistance and the time commitment. We realize this is a lot of work for a lot of people, and all the panel members have been very accommodating and assisting us, so we really appreciate all that help.
Thank you. Yes, thanks everyone. It's a group team effort, that's for sure. Maureen, did you have anything to report on your subgroup?
Yeah, sure. So we held a meeting, it might have been last week, my memory is fuzzy, but we held a meeting on bioenergy end use that was attended by a lot of other advisory panels. It was very interesting. And the waste panel joined, as they are, you know, a potential source for bioenergy and also a potential end user, as was the energy intensive and trade exposed industries, transportation, power generation, housing were all present and participated in that meeting. So, you know, we had some discussions. We had a presentation given on some potential end use scenarios and then had a discussion around, you know, what those might mean. I think it was really good to get the other panels thinking about, you know, the end use. We wanted to communicate this, you know, this very limited potential resource, and, you know, that we have to think very strongly about highest and best end use for any bioenergy recommendation that might go forward from other panels into the advisory panel process, into their recommendations. We are going to follow up. Our next step is to tackle this biorefining concept, which is more future-looking, more of an R&D type concept. So we'll be organizing another meeting on that topic. And, you know, we haven't pulled together any strong recommendations. So I think what we'll likely do is have a focused subgroup meeting where we don't invite other people, so we can just talk amongst ourselves about where we think we might push forth recommendations and where the bioeconomy serves as an enabler, you know, to maintain supply chain to meet future needs versus actual direct emissions reductions or direct, you know, sequestration benefits. So there's, you know, we'll have to kind of lay that out. So that's, and of course, you know, we also have our earlier thoughts on substitution, you know, looking at substituting bio-based products for fossil-based products to increase the use, you know, reduce the use of fossil-based products and increase, you know, our bioeconomy here in New York.
Excellent. Great. Any questions for any of our subgroup presenters? Wow, I guess that's a great job by our presenters. A couple of things, you know, obviously our goal and hope is that the subgroups know they're setting up to have some more meetings, that hopefully they can complete their work for early in March, for that March 2nd meeting. Pay close attention to your emails. You'll be getting some more information about that. Next panel dates coming up. We're looking at March 2nd. We're looking at March 16th, both of them to start at 1 o'clock. So we're starting to see the culmination of an awful lot of effort, an awful lot of work, to quote Peter, an awful lot of input from a lot of people and a lot of help there. So if I think we have a public engagement session coming up here in a few minutes. If there's nothing else to come before us right now, I'm going to recommend. Oh, excuse me. One other thing I forgot about. Yeah, the next full council meeting of the CAC is going to be February 17th. That's going to be a Wednesday. That's going to be at 2 p.m. And as usual, we encourage you to listen in on that, pay attention, and hear what's going on at that level. But if we don't have anything else to come before us, I might suggest that everybody, please, if you're planning to listen in on the public engagement session, which we encourage, you will not be asked to participate, but it's just an opportunity for you to hear what people are concerned about, ask some questions of a moderator, get a feel for our work and broadly as we've gone forward here. But I would suggest that you stay logged in if you intend to do that. Maybe put yourself on mute, stand up, stretch your legs, do a couple push-ups, cut down a tree, I don't know. Relax for a minute, and we'll be back promptly at 2:30. So with that, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll go get my chainsaw started.